Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 3 issues for just £5. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to Black's History Week. In this 5th podcast to mark the presidential election, Professor Jeremy Black, author of Altered States, talks to The Critic's political editor, Graham Stewart, about how the power of the US president has been exercised since the end of the Cold War.
Presidential election time is a period in which Americans look forward to the next 4 years and what politics may have on offer. But it's also a time to reflect on the more immediate past and the longer term past in terms of what the history of the presidency does to those who occupy the White House. In this series with Professor Black, we've been looking at the better part of the last 200 years of the presidency. In this episode, which I should say we're recording just before the results of the presidential election come in, we are looking at the more immediate past, the last 25 years, but also putting that in the wider context of the whole period of the US presidency from George Washington onwards. With that in mind, Professor Black, I want to start by asking you about a comparison between the 42nd president, William Jefferson Clinton, and the 3rd president, Thomas Jefferson, about 190 years earlier. So much had changed in the United States during that time spell. It'd gone from an agrarian society to an industrial and a consumer society, from 13 states on the eastern seaboard to 50 states. Is it meaningful to say that actually, despite all this, the presidency had not changed that much in the sense of how the Constitution framed its role? Would William Jefferson Clinton approach the role of presidency in the same way that Thomas and Jefferson did?
Well, that's a very interesting, it's what's known as a diachronic comparison. So that's a comparison across time. And those kind of comparisons are always much harder to address than comparisons in the same time period, because if you're looking at the same time period, you've got the same kind of technology. So, for example, let us say there'd been a problem in a distant state. A president of the 1990s can get on an aeroplane, can hear about it on the telephone, can read about it on the internet, whatever, whereas the constraints of distance are completely and utterly different in the case of a man like Jefferson, who was president in the 1800s. Having said that, given that America has an historical constitution, a constitution which looks back, whereas most of the rest of the world, which we can include here, pretty well every state in Europe, Britain, Japan, China, India, have all had new constitutions from the 1940s onwards. People may be surprised to hear that if one's referring to Britain, but if you think about it, the new government arrangements of Scotland and Wales in the 1990s, all the changes in the House of Lords, changes to the Supreme, the creation of the Supreme Court, all constituted parts of a new constitution. But in the case of America, we've still got a historic constitution, so it's valid to ask that question. And I would personally say that you've still got the same essential problems, ones we've highlighted going forward. So in other words, the relationship between whatever you consider the key elements to be at the federal level and the issues at the state level, with obviously Jefferson in the 1800s being very much more on the state side and then finding himself president, of course. And again, the tensions between the different branches of the Constitution as classically understood, Congress, the judiciary, or the Supreme Court, I should say, and the presidency. And I don't think that's changed. And there's also another more specific comparison. I mean, in many senses, both Jefferson and Clinton were, to a degree, Southern outsiders. Jefferson is the first of the non-federalists to become president. He is personally antipathetical to the federalist system. In fact, much of his propaganda is a sort of early prelude to the drain the swamp, with the swamp being Philadelphia and the National Bank. And in a way, you could say the same thing for President Clinton from Arkansas, a kind of, again, southerner from outside the magic circle. Of course, what's hilarious is that Clinton turned himself into a highly privileged member of such a magic circle, but, you know, in particular reacting against 12 years of Republican rule, but also the way in which the Democratic Party had very much had during that 12 years, had very much become a group of to which he was an outsider. So, yes, I think there are comparisons, but I mean, I think there are also contrasts, and to me, the obvious contrast, I mean, I don't personally take much to Jefferson. I think he was I did a book on the War of 1812, and I can't but be struck about the idiotic advice Jefferson gave as an ex-president that if they attacked, they could conquer Quebec and Montreal in a year and Halifax the next year, and the British would fail. And so, you know, this kind of nutty, kind of complete failure to understand the situation he was in. So, in many senses, I think Jefferson was is a much overrated figure, but nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that his integrity will emerge differently in the historical record to that of President Clinton. I hope that remark isn't going to get me served with a writ, but I think most people would accept that.
Well, one thing that certainly changed between the period of Thomas Jefferson and Bill Clinton is the nature of party politics in the United States. Bill Clinton's an interesting figure because obviously he's the Democrat candidate, but he has a pitch which attempts to triangulate various different positions, including including ground that's generally been Republican territory, such as law and order and a focus on reducing the deficit. Should we see Bill Clinton as one of those presidents who attempted to appeal beyond party and to be a national figure, even if that didn't work out in the end for him?
Well, I don't want to labour the point, but I mean, he was a national figure in the sense that he was concerned for himself. I don't think he was particularly constrained by his party. He was willing to be all things to all men, and he had the great advantage in the 1992 election that President H.W. Bush appeared tired, whilst Bush's willingness to raise taxes had been an issue in, I would suggest, sapping Republican support for his candidacy. I mean, I think Clinton was very much a Tony Blair character, somebody who was very strong on the image, actually policy light. And of course, I mean, he was able to, in 92, to benefit strongly from the fact that there was a third party candidate. I mean, Clinton himself won 43% of the vote in 92, so he didn't win an absolute majority of the vote, but of course, Ross Perot got 19%. And I think that's quite significant. I mean, you know, a very major difference. We're discussing this on the 29th of October, listeners might like to note, but a major difference, which we can already tell, is that there is not going to be a significant third-party vote to sway the presidential election or to heavily influence it, as happened on a number of occasions, and not just in 92. I mean, you can also think about the role of George Wallace earlier. I mean, there are other cases as well.
Rafe Nader as well.
Yeah, no, you know, there's a whole host. I mean, but Nader himself, yes, had an influence, no doubt, but certainly didn't make it in percentage terms into becoming a very major a figure as some of the others have done, and go back to 48, for example, and the Dixiecrats have an impact. So I think that, in a way, Clinton you can say it in different ways, and obviously listeners will have their own view, and in many senses, as you correctly say, they will tend to be thinking very much in the perspective of the present day. Well, you know, my own view is this. I feel able to criticize President Clinton without in any way it being implied that I support or don't support any particular candidate in 2020. So I would suggest to you that President Clinton, who had a period of office in which America was extraordinarily prosperous, in which the Soviet Union had collapsed, in which China was not yet an opponent, and in which for part of the period he had a majority in Congress, I would say that President Clinton totally and utterly wasted the situation. And you know, he was clearly a facile man, but I think that he was a very poor president. And I'm not primarily thinking here about his personal life, though that took up a disproportionate amount of his time and showed him as a man of no integrity. What I'm thinking more is that in political terms, he squandered opportunities, and I'm not impressed by him. And I can't help but wondering whether, you know, one always has to be careful about these kind of phrases, and counterfactuals, you know, can get one into trouble. But I do actually think that George H.W. Bush was a more impressive candidate in 92, and in many senses, Bob Dole in 96. So, you know, one has to be careful here. A lot of people would be horrified by those suggestions because sort of Clinton sort of is somebody like Blair who has, you know, as it were, passed to a sort of almost totemic figure because they symbolize a kind of, ironically, a pre-populist age. In fact, both men were populists of a certain type, but they symbolize an age different to today, and a lot of people who are uneasy, unhappy, or downright opposed to aspects of the present age therefore look back. But no, there was something distinctly sleazy and just wasted about the Clinton years.
Well, all presidents, I suppose, are beneficiaries or victims of circumstance to some extent. Bill Clinton found himself president at a time when America was, with the collapse of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet Union, was perceived as the hyperpower. So it's almost like going back to the period of Dwight Eisenhower in terms of an apex of American power, perhaps more so in that America in the 50s had the Cold War confrontation. But he had the benefit of an economic boom, which not necessarily of his making, but of which, nevertheless, he made the most of. But he loses Congress. You talk about him squandering his opportunities, Professor Black. Losing Congress, how significant was that for Clinton? How significant is it really for any president who wants to have a sustained legacy?
Well, you're right. The congressional elections of 94... meant that the Republicans gained control of the House for the first time in 40 years. I mean, that's pretty big. I mean, so they won 52 seats in the House and 9 in the Senate. And, you know, I mean, that was a nadir for Clinton. I mean, it really put him in a very, very difficult situation. Now, he was helped, of course, by the extent to which Newt Gingrich then tried to push his position of the Republicans in the House in a sort of intolerant, moralizing, unfunded tax cuts, you know, in a way as undesirable as Clinton's. The Americans got two very unpleasant choices. As you say, people win elections in part because of those who are on the other side. And I think that does help Clinton in the 96 presidential election, where in percentage terms, he actually does better than he's done in 92, largely because Perot goes down. So it becomes 50% for Clinton, 41% for Dole, and 9% for Perot or Perot. You know, people can see that the Republicans, and the Republicans go on dominating the House, they couldn't, as it were, provide themselves with an ability either to execute policy successfully or, in fact, to bring down Clinton. So one has a situation in which in the late 90s, and I think this is a great tragedy for America and for the world, you have a president who's tarnished, let's just put it like that. You have a Republican position in Congress, which is increasingly finding it difficult to sort of produce something that's viable. And people often are critical of the Tea Party, justifiably so, but in my view, the Tea Party movement could already be seen in Genesis in some of the ideas and individuals to the fore in the late 1990s. And I don't think it's a great period of triumph for American politics. Now, as you say, America is very wealthy at that period, but I don't think it's a great triumph. And I think, you know, one way of looking at it is that the American system is such that as far as domestic affairs are concerned, the Americans are better placed than most societies to cope with, shall we say, below par government. Secondly, however parlous America is, there is a self-righting process offered by measures such as impeachment, such as the ability of the judiciary to maintain independence, such as trade-offs between independent parts of the political system. So that's very different to China or Russia. And the level of corruption, though it exists there, doesn't really approach, shall we say, Indian or Italian or Spanish levels of political corruption. So I think that there are major advantages America has, but it's not saying very much if what you're saying is the major advantage is that the government can be weak and the rest of society can still keep going and deliver a basic competence. But I think that that is, in a sense, what was happening in the United States in the late 90s. And ironically, what it does is it, in a sense, prepares the background to some of the disastrous situations that to affect America and international relations in the 2000s, so that you know, people often date many of the failures to the Bush presidency in 2001-2009, and my job isn't to go into bat to defend Bush, but I'm always interested in continuities, and many of the problems that affected Bush, in particular better relations between Russia and China, the problems created by concern about Saddam Hussein, and the sense that he hadn't been constrained adequately, and the extent to which Al-Qaeda remained a body able to operate in North America, as was shown brutally in 2001. All of those had been issues present in the Clinton administration. And so that you could say, I mean, reiterating the point I'd made, I mean, when we would generally look at Clinton's failures, if we're Europeans, you know, we would tend to think, oh my God, why didn't they improve the infrastructure, introduce effective social welfare, do something about gun control, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all of which are perfectly reasonable propositions to make and wouldn't have shocked a lot of Americans in the past. But you can also approach it from just from the point of view of the perspective of the national security presidency and say, you know, why on earth was Clinton so absolutely useless at international relations as opposed to sound bites?
Well, I mean, one of the most immediate legacies of Bill Clinton's term or two terms in office is that his vice president, Al Gore, then doesn't get elected. And Al Gore distances himself during that presidential campaign, partly because Clinton has tarnished his presidency, but by his own behaviour. Nevertheless, do you think in analysing why Bush won and Gore lost, Gore missed the opportunity there? He should have associated himself with the economic good times of the Clinton years, or actually was foreign policy and the failures of Clinton's foreign policy beginning to play up in American minds, and they in a way anticipated the importance of foreign policy that was to come during the Bush years, albeit the war on terror was brought upon America rather than looked for?
Well, first of all, Gore, as you know, got more votes than George W. Gore got 51 million, George W. got 50.5 million. So I wouldn't say that voters decided A rather than B. I think it's more even balanced. And I mean, Bush was to do better in the 2004 election. So as far as 2000 is concerned, I think Gore suffered by appearing dull. I think that was important. I think he suffered because he couldn't carry his own state, which I think was a really major failing. I mean, Tennessee. And it's interesting that most of the South went easily Republican. And of course, the state that caused the most hanging problem, which was the Florida with its recounts, was a state which has a fair number of retired Northerners in it. So, in a way, the Republicans, I mean, without the equivalent of a diversion of Ross Perot, and benefiting from the fact that I think that there was already a sort of sense of unhappiness, and again, we're talking about a roughly evenly spread electorate, a sense of unhappiness with quite a lot of the Clinton domestic agenda. I don't think, I mean, I was in America for the 2000 campaign, and indeed on election night, I remember going to bed. I'd given a lecture that day in Beaumont, Texas, and, you know, I'm not a good sleeper, and I was aware there was an election going on, so I switched on the television during much of the night, and they simply couldn't make up their mind what was going to happen. And I remember next day going for a swim, and there were a couple of Americans having a row in the changing room, or what I think they'd call the locker room, and one of them saying, oh, you know, Gore shouldn't be so snitty. And it was that sort of, you know, it wouldn't be any more profound in Britain, the level of political debate. But I can remember, I don't think that I noticed much of foreign policy coming to the fore in that election. I think that in part, Gore lost it because he was unable to come across with much charisma or even, dare I say, interest. And to an extent, that replicated the situation with George H.W. Bush in 1992. And I think that both men, I mean, I happen to think George H.W. Bush was a much more impressive figure, but I think both men were weak as politicians.
Do you feel that we look on George W. Bush's presidency too much through the prism of the war on terror? Has that crowded out a more balanced assessment of his time in the White House?
I think that's a very interesting question. I mean, I think there's no doubt at all about it that there were other matters there. I think there's no two ways about that. And you're right that particularly foreigners are apt to emphasize very much the external dimension. I mean, there was all sorts of things. There was, you know, the government deficit, which by 2005 was, you know, really quite high. There were the cuts in income tax rates in 2003. There was the massive expansion in Medicare. So the act was passed, I think, in 2003, but I don't think it came into effect in 2006, which creates an enormous expansion in entitlement. And so, you know, domestic policy is very significant, and, you know, I can go on and on and on about that. Which incidentally means that if you want to look at the war as being the thing that stuffed the finances, rather like you would be talking about Vietnam in the 60s, you need to bear in mind that actually it was Republican domestic politics in terms of expanding entitlements and cutting taxation which helped to stuff it, just as the Democrats with Great Society had caused a hell of a lot of problems in the 60s. So yes, I think there is a domestic agenda there which is significant. And again, the comparison with Johnson is deliberate, because not that I'm implying that George W. Bush was an individual of Johnson's political or governmental caliber. That would be mistaken. But what I'm simply saying is that under Johnson, the debacle over Vietnam, slow-moving debacle, crowds out the question of the implementation of Great Society and indeed the response to increasing social discontent. And in the 2000s, the debacle in Iraq crowds out a lot of consideration of domestic politics. So yes, I would agree with that is a way to look at the period.
Well, with Barack Obama, his election campaign is packaged in a way quite similar to John F. Kennedy, a new president of the 60s. Obama, posters of hope, and a focus on reviving the domestic politics. Is it right to say that actually Obamacare is what Barack Obama will be remembered for, in the same way that the war on terror dominates our perception of George W. Bush?
Well, I don't know what it's going to be remembered for. I can only guess no more than you can. I mean, what I would say is that if you're electing a president, you're electing a head of state, and it's very difficult for British people to understand that because a prime minister is not a head of state in Britain. If you're electing a head of state, you're looking essentially for two different characteristics. You're looking for what you might regard as a CEO, somebody that can manage the state, and you're looking for somebody who is a head of state. And I suppose that Obama, as a young black man, encapsulated a kind of aspiration for a different America, and that obviously proved very attractive to many of the electors, that the actual ability he might then have to sort of, as it were, take his business through Congress, or indeed his foreign policy through a difficult and troubled world, were not necessarily matched the moment of victory in his election. And again, we shouldn't be surprised about this. He's clearly a clever man, from what one understands. He's rather arrogant, but then I suppose people who aren't arrogant don't get to be president. I don't know. He was correct to argue that there should be, quote, a pivot towards Asia, which I think was his term. He didn't, though, actually do very much about achieving that. He was somebody who was often better at discerning or defining problems than at producing solutions. And I think you could argue that that was true of his domestic politics. I think you could argue that that was, to an extent, true of his foreign policy. And you could argue that that was true of his position as the leading figure in the Democratic Party. I imagine that it must be a matter of great regret to President Obama that he was succeeded by President Trump. But he must wonder, and I don't imagine he's ever going to say anything about this, he must wonder whether, in a way, Trump, in part, won his presidency because, again, of the nature of the opposition. Senator Clinton, who was regarded by many Americans, not by all Americans, but by many Americans, as having a whole host of undesirable characteristics. And you must wonder, as to whether Obama would have been better placed bringing forward other potential figures to produce a better contest or a more broadly based contest for the Democratic leadership. I don't know. There's all sorts of things, but if you're a two-term president, you might say that one of your tasks ought to be to think about how your political party or your program should be sustained after you've stood down. And that certainly didn't happen with President Obama.
Well, we're getting dangerously close to election day now. And as we said at the outset, we've recorded this just before the presidential elections. We're going to discuss the legacy of President Trump or President Trump's first term, depending on how the voters react. But I want to end by a question not about the presidency, but about the vice presidency. Looking at the period since Reagan, we have had vice presidents like George H.W. Bush, who became president, and vice presidents like Al Gore, who didn't, and Joe Biden, well, watch this space. Does the role of vice president change in any appreciable way since the period after Ronald Reagan, so the last 30 or so years? And does it provide meaningful training for the top job?
Can I just go back there before you do that? As you say, we're speaking on October the 29th, and we have had a previous discussion about counterfactualisms. I think this is an absolutely classic example of where counterfactualism is valid. It is entirely appropriate, given that figures around the world of political weight and economic significance, let alone commentators such as us, will be considering what happens, even when there is a 10% spread in the polls, which is a large spread by the standards of elections. People will be considering what is likely to happen if one or other scenario occurs. And I think that this exemplifies why it is so foolish for so many historians to treat the past in a deterministic and teleological fashion, and it is lazy and stupid. Now, let us go on to look at vice presidents. Well, first of all, the bigger picture remains the case that whereas vice presidents for a long time were intended to, quote, balance the ticket, in other words, to often appeal to figures who were very, very different in their political allegiance and regional power base. So, you know, you can think of Abraham Lincoln and Johnson. You can think again of Kennedy and Johnson, and that this helps to explain transition issues. I think you can fairly say that that was not so much the case more recently. So, you know, Gore and Clinton had a lot of similarities. So did Biden and Obama, and so indeed to Pence and Trump. I'm not saying necessarily similarities as individuals. I'm saying more within the same policy set. And from that point of view, I think it's fair to say that being vice president is a training to continue the policies or attitudes of the existing president. But I think it's also reasonable to say that in part being vice president depends upon what circumstances and the views of the president of the day thrusts towards you as your responsibilities. So you recall when we were talking about Eisenhower, I made the point that Nixon under Eisenhower was given some quite significant roles in terms of presenting American foreign policy. I think it's fair to say that that has not always been the case, that generally presidents of the modern age have tried to keep foreign policy very close to their heart because of their influence. And even a man who was getting elderly, such as Ronald Reagan, went to Reykjavik to negotiate with Gorbachev because it was quite clearly, in his view, not appropriate to have a vice president go and do that, even though the vice president at the time, George H.W. Bush, had considerable foreign policy experience. In fact, what some of the best foreign policy experience of a modern American vice president. So a lot depends upon circumstance. I don't think there's any inevitable pattern. It's not as formless as, shall we say, the position in Britain, where a deputy prime minister has existed in recent years, but without there necessarily being clarity as to what that entails. And I think that the American situation is a necessary one because you have, in effect, in the president a monarch, and in the event of the death of that monarch or the incapacity of that monarch, you need another monarch to replace him or her, and that is the vice president. Whether you would argue that the present situation prepares them adequately for that position is a matter that I think you'd best decide by interviewing some vice presidents.
Well, that opens up many possibilities. For the moment, Professor Jeremy Black, we will call it time there. Next week, we will be looking at the legacy of Donald Trump in historical perspective. But for now, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
If you've enjoyed listening to The Critic podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the offer of 3 issues for just £5 by heading to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk.